Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Virtue. Welcome to AnCast. This is our 25th episode, actually.
Woohoo!
Isn't that, what is that, silver?
I don't know. So
who
off
cares?
My radar, I'm not even...
So, we're kind of in the middle of the season right now. We're both watching, still watching Da-da-da-da, which we'll talk about that when the show is over.
Right.
But we decided to sort of reach back into the old school, and neither of us had ever even tried to watch Legend of the Galactic Heroes.
Right. And this is a show I've had kicking around in my library for years, and I've always avoided it because it's like 100+ episodes.
Yeah.
And it always had that stink of space opera mired in tactics and political drama that could quickly become ponderous.
Yeah, it always had this stigma, and I've known about it since I became an anime fan. I mean, it's been around since the 80s.
Yeah.
And it always had this air of it, of this inaccessible thing that I'm just, pretty much everybody I knew who was into it was like, hey, you're not going to like it. You
right.
know, they basically, the fans warded me off. Like, I wasn't going to appreciate it or enjoy it because it's just too much. It's too complicated, you know. Oh, it's basically an animated version of, you know, people playing a game of Risk.
Yeah, that's how it was told me, too.
In space. And
there's any way to dissuade me from watching a show.
Yeah, and so I finally watched it, and all of that was wrong.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's excellent, actually.
In fact, it's one of the best anime series I've seen in years.
Well, you haven't watched enough of it, really, to make that claim yet, but...
I will predict.
Yeah, I'm about 8 episodes into it, and the premise is fairly basic. There's two sides fighting a war in space. I mean,
right.
There's an Imperial side, and then there's this sort of weird... There's an alliance of free planets that have formed a UN kind of a thing.
And both are jerks in completely different ways.
Yeah, they're both weirdly fascist. Like, there isn't really a good guy.
Right.
There are good guys on either side, but there's no... Like, it's not bad civilization versus good civilization. It's here's two kind of fucked up civilizations going at it.
One more of a classic-style monarchy.
Yeah, and the other is basically, you know, political dictator or whatever, you know. It's
I would say more like, you know, warmongering democracy at its worst.
Yeah, that's probably accurate. But and to preface this, those first two episodes are kind of killer. And but what you're watching is important. You're watching this battle that turns out to be a major event in the history of this war. And while you're watching it, I can understand anyone watching those first two episodes. I thought immediately, oh, this is exactly what everybody told me it was.
Yeah, I had that concern.
But I stuck with it through those two, and you have to stick with it. And immediately in the third episode, suddenly there's interesting characters. I gave a shit about who everyone was and what was going on.
The first two episodes more or less set up the roles of the young commanders on either side that are clearly going to become pivotal in the war.
Yeah, and you need that background information. It's too bad they just kind of it sits there like a spitball at the very beginning of the show.
Well, what I would like it to is like the first two episodes of Full Metal Alchemist, where it's just it plops you in the middle of a fight and you don't have really anything invested in it emotionally.
Yeah, that's not a good way to. Dear Japan, stop starting shows that way.
You, if you don't have anything invested, you can't get behind the characters and you don't really care what happens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everybody has. There's such a huge cast. Everybody has their name subtitled beneath their portrait. It'll have their name subtitled beneath it, which is important because it's a huge cast, but there's really only like 4 or 5 main characters so far that I've seen. And it's not that hard to keep track of.
Not to mention, I'll admit, those character names are challenging.
Oh, I laughed out loud. There's one guy named Muckenberger.
when any war drama does that, it automatically worries me.
The thing that I would compare it to, and this is it's a weak comparison, and I will be called on it, but I think it's apt. If you found yourself getting into the new Battlestar Galactica, there might be something here for you because it's a lot of character drama. It's solid science fiction. It has nowhere near the level of really affecting human emotion that Battlestar Galactica had, but there are similarities in terms of just being good human science fiction that I think fans of something like Battlestar Galactica or like Babylon 5 will enjoy this show. Unfortunately, it is never going to be available legally in America.
No, and you know, there's still like this half-hearted fan effort to get someone to license it, but now I think everyone's finally given up on the prospect because of, well, this show is really completely unsaleable.
Yeah, it is, and that's kind of a shame, because I think if somebody had taken the plunge 10 years ago, I think they might have done okay with it, if they sold it right.
Right.
But I've never seen anyone sell this thing right.
No, it's a show that is clearly geared for, like, our age.
Yeah.
For a more mature adult audience, the sort of people that would like Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very heady, and, you know, there are whole episodes that are just talking, really.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a challenge. It doesn't appeal to the core teen boy demographic that, you know, everybody always shoots for, regardless who the show is actually for.
Right.
And so, yeah, this would require actual, like, creative marketing that I don't think even at the peak of the bubble anyone was capable of.
I think if you sold it the same way they sold a Babylon 5 or a Battlestar Galactica, I could see, I think its time has passed. Whatever success it could have had, it's done now.
And especially because the first few episodes were animated in 88.
Yeah.
And even though because it's all OAVs, even though it's 100 episodes plus.
Yeah, which is a wacky. I don't think that's... There isn't another example of that, is there?
No, this is historically the longest OVA in history.
Right.
It wasn't... The novels weren't popular enough in Japan to make it a series. So they started off making an OVA, and it caught fire, kind of. But they just kept going with it for, like, 15 years.
Yeah.
And so... It's a challenge to market, even if it was all freshly animated. The fact that the first half of it is, you know, very old cell paint and everything, it's, forget it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would say, like, if you're a science fiction fan, if you're an adult science fiction fan, you know, it's well-written drama. It's solid stuff, and I really would like to see, it'll never happen, but I would like to see the stigma go away of it being this inaccessible, horribly nerdy, it's all... boring space tactics and shit. It's not at all that. I found it to be very entertaining.
Yeah. So if you are making the same mistake we did or just haven't heard of it before, you know, I would highly recommend you check it out. It's one of the keepers.
Yeah, good stuff. And a really nice surprise. So other than that, I watched another old thing that you remastered yourself, actually.
Yeah, one of my nerdy DVD side projects.
Yeah, it was Night on the Galactic Railroad, which I liked. I think I would regard it more as some kind of a masterpiece if I had seen it maybe 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked it. I'm surprised it took me so long to see it, and I liked it a lot more because I had seen this guy, Kenji Miyazawa.
Yeah.
I've seen his other film, Spring and Chaos.
Right. That's his biopic.
That's his biopic. This is much better than that, yeah. I thought. Spring and Chaos was kind of a mess, I thought.
I got a lot out of it, but had I not already been a huge Galactic Railroad fan, I would have probably not.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know anything about the guy going into it.
Right.
So, and then I learned about it after having seen it, but... So Night on the Galactic Railroad, is this even available still? Can you get
this anywhere? This was a CPM title that sold, like, literally... This was one of the 2,000 or 3,000 unit sellers.
Okay.
This one tanked. And that...
Where did you put it on your buried treasure meter? Can you still buy it? Like, can you go to Amazon?
This is one of those things that, like, enough people know that it's good and didn't buy it in time, where if you go on Half.com or Amazon on Marketplace, it's, like, $60 plus.
Oh, okay.
And that DVD doesn't even look very good because it comes from the old LD Master. That's why I bought the Region 2 and redid it.
Yeah. So you're, I mean, you've seen this a lot more than I have.
Oh, yes.
Describe the story.
All right. Well, it's based on a children's story that would really only be fully appreciated by adults, I think.
Yeah.
It's a children's story that everyone in Japan knows, where it kind of takes place in this weird kind of fantasy pagan Italy, I guess, where, little boy, his father has, you know, gone off on a hunting expedition that hasn't been heard from in ages. He's just kind of in this space of being, you know, put down by life. And it's the night of the festival, and he hopes to meet up with his friend, who seems kind of strangely distant, and enjoy the festival together. He ends up having to run an errand for his sick mother and kind of dawdling, and there in the distance is this, you know, train that pulls up, and he finds himself intrigued and getting on it, and there's his friend sitting there. And the train shoots off into the stars, and they explore the fantasy reaches of space together. If that sounds kind of familiar, it's literally what inspired Galaxy Express and you know, a lot of the Matsumoto verse. If you study, you know, Miyazawa, you can see where all of this came from, but you know, obviously that's not something we'd expect most people to do.
Right.
But it's, I love this movie both for its mood and its kind of starry-eyed attempt at not even attempt, but starry-eyed construct of kind of a fantasy realm that doesn't serve any established fantasy purpose. It's completely off on its own.
Yeah, it really is. It's an art film. Like, it very much is a piece, an art piece. Right. It's not a traditional narrative in that sense. And to me, like, I described it this way. It really feels like a sort of an existentialist children's book to watch. And the illustration style is very much like that.
Yes.
I think the visuals were probably more impressive in the 80s. Nowadays, they seem a little pedestrian.
Yeah, it hasn't aged well visually.
Yeah, I think it is still a beautiful film. It's just, I think what was meant to be spectacular then now is merely, oh, that's nice.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're in the mood for something that it's definitely very thoughtful and ethereal to sit there and watch it, you kind of have to be in the right mood to watch this thing. So, you know, if you're if you're into navel gazing, or if you really just, you know, feel like dipping your toe into the world of art cinema, it's a good place to start, I would say.
If you can find it.
If you can find it, yeah, which you can't.
This is one of those rare anime that your library might be your best bet.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it is literature-based, and so they did sell quite a few in that direction, I think.
Yeah, so next week we'll talk about new stuff, I promise. This is really old shit we're talking about.
You know what? It's good to step back. I enjoy it. There is so much good old stuff that nobody bothers with.
Yeah.
It's worthwhile to look back, I think.
I'm definitely glad. I mean, I'm glad I experienced both of these things. It was I should do that more often. Okay, let's go ahead and bring the guest in.
All right.
Okay, we're back. Our guest this week is producer extraordinaire Joseph Cho. Thanks a lot for being here.
Producer extraordinaire. Oh, thank you.
I've read your resume, and I've seen you around a lot. Like, I mean, I've met you a few times. How did you get, you got your start at Warner Home Video?
Yep, that's correct. Prior to that, I mean, I was involved in the game industry for a while, and then I went to grad school, and I figured I need to really get into filmmaking or anime, which was my passion for a long time. So I was looking for an opportunity. So once it opened up at Warner's, and I took it, and that's where I got. I was fortunate because when I arrived, Animatrix was just gearing up.
Oh, right, right.
So me being, at the time, DVD was booming so much. Mm-hmm. And because of the growth of DVD and the whole, like, booming of the anime genre, I just couldn't stop talking about, Warner having to get into that genre. And I guess I kind of, fed nicely into the, the Animatrix, business development. So, yeah, that's really where I got my start in anime.
Now, so you started out as a fan. What were you into?
Well, I mean, I was really lucky because I grew up in Korea, in my, up to, like, when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And in Korea, like, during the 80s, you could pretty much see a lot of classic, what you would call classic anime series on TV. So anything from Mazinger to Grandizer to Galaxy Express, 999 and Harlock. All of those things were on pretty much at the same time on TV. So, I kind of grew up on classics. And then I kind of segued into, some people, because Korea is so close to Japan, a lot of people bring in, like, videotapes that they recorded off the TV and whatnot. So you get your exposure to Gundam and everything. So, I was getting exposed to pretty much, like, 20, 30 years of anime pretty much at the same time.
Yeah.
And that really kind of, fed into my childhood development, per se.
Well, what
made you want to get involved, so to speak? I mean, what were you kind of out to accomplish for yourself?
Well, I come from sort of like, you know, my family is sort of the entertainment background. So I always wanted to get into entertainment and movies and animation was really, top of my list. My mother, who was an actress, actually discouraged me from that. So I decided to get into business, but I guess I really couldn't, kind of let go of my childhood passion. So I really wanted to get back in there. I mean, initially I was thinking I might want to become a director, but then I kind of found out that, I'd rather kind of stay in the background and become a producer. But the title of a producer is it's a difficult thing to define a job of producer. I mean, there's nothing that you can apply, as a producer title, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just apply to a producer job. So I kind of had to find my place for it. But eventually that's, where I was heading.
I see a lot of hacks calling themselves producers that really don't really do much. At the same time, a lot of people that work their butts off.
Yeah, it seems like it's a wide spectrum of talent that winds up calling themselves a producer. So you had a hand in the Animatrix. What was your involvement with that project, and what did you think of the final outcome?
Well, I mean, Animatrix was, I think just around the time in college, I guess one of the, one of the fan servers actually when I was in college,
okay.
I actually kind of oversaw. I mean, it wasn't for like any like a VHS trading or anything like that, but I actually got into, subbing some of the Nausicaa and like some of the Miyazaki movies and some anime. And then somehow got a clearance from the university TV station to use their equipment to subtitle them and air them. So
wow.
I found my bunch of Japanese translators.
Government subsidized piracy.
Yeah, wow.
Yes. So we aired it on university TV. I think I still might have a copy of that. I kind of started from that point on. And I think just around that time, I was getting exposed to Ninja Scroll and all those titles when they were first being imported, I guess, illegally. Because at the time, only Streamline and these guys were putting out some anime. But so only way to really get to anime in real time and really to get to their vast library is to go to these conventions and talk to these VHS vendors,
right.
Who legally sell these fan subs and whatnot. And I think, that's when I started getting turned on to Kawajiri and whatnot. Director Kawajiri, who directed Ninja Scroll.
Right.
And I think, and I really kind of started researching books from Japan and Korea, on the topic of Japanese anime industry. So when I just arrived in Warner's, I mean, the Animatrix were already on the way. I mean, I can't take credit for that project, starting or, being developed or at all, because I kind of came in from the business end. Mm-hmm. And at the time, my task was, marketing and sort of a business development. But, just imagine my surprise, being a big fan of it and wanting to get into that space. And I was already kind of researching, every time I would go into stores, I would check the prices of videos and DVDs and how that kind of mapped against, different stores and different countries and whatnot. I mean, that was already in my head. I would actually play that in my head a lot. And once I get into Warner's, and just imagine my surprise, all of that kind of coming together in Animatrix, where director Kawajiri was working on one and, Watanabe-san was working on, a couple episodes. So it was already there. And then this where I made a lot of friends who actually worked on the title as well. I initially, my reaction was, wow, what is this? It's very, experimental. But it wasn't a typical anime per se that you would, think of. But I mean, the quality really was excellent. I think the directors got to really express themselves. And obviously, I mean, it was riding on the really the, Matrix's height of, popularity at the time. And really the buzz for all of that was really amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the result was really good. I mean, I think it was probably, if not the best, it's one of the best selling anime titles in the world.
Yeah.
I think it probably hit about 3.5 million units.
I can say definitively that was one of the best selling anime titles in the world.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, if you count Advent Children as anime, maybe it's a little more, you know, if you add in the complete edition, the follow-up to Advent Children.
Right.
So if you add them all together, I think then that might be the best-selling anime. But if you don't consider that an anime, then I think Animatrix is the best-selling anime.
Oddly enough, wound up being better than the Matrix sequels.
I would say so. A lot of people actually said it was actually better than, you know, any of the sequels that came up. And internally speaking, I think a lot of people felt the same way. I mean, there was a lot of nervousness because of the money that was being spent on it and the time that we spent on it. And it, you know, I mean, normally a major studio doesn't jump on multi-million dollar animation project like that easily.
Not only that, anthology films have a terrible history.
Yeah, I mean, that too. I really also think it's not really the caliber of the directors at the time. I think because a lot, you know, the major public who actually bought into it were really kind of coming into it as a part of the Matrix world, per se. So I think, you know, it really was the first title to really kind of expose major public to what we would call, you know, anime. You know, I mean, subsequently, I had a hard time explaining anime to the Warner executives, you know, how that's different from animation and how that's not all about being cyberpunk and violent and sexual and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But it really did, however, I mean, it really opened a lot of people's eyes to, you know, this, you know, genre or medium.
Yeah, that was an impressive DVD. And I always thought anime fans, like, didn't really seem to grasp, at least the community at large, didn't seem to grasp how big a deal it was to have a really high-selling, popular anime DVD out there that not only was totally mainstream, but it had a featurette on the disc that said, here's anime, here's why it's cool, here's why you should be into it. Mm-hmm. It was a huge recruiting tool, you know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I also remember that's actually when anime was riding on, I guess it's what's the height of the bubble, you might say, or I'm not sure if you would call it bubble at this point, but it really was height of anime at the time, right?
That was what, 04?
03, I think.
03.
Yeah, when DVD was growing despite the dot-com burst and anime was riding on top of it, and it was like $500 million market at the time. And I think it was just riding that wave as well, so.
And now it is crying.
Yeah, you might say that.
So what was your next project after that?
What happened was, because it was such a successful title and, you know, obviously a major studio is always looking for another, you know, genre to get into, and Warner didn't have any exposure at all other than Pokemon. And it was even a huge task to even get them to try to understand that, you know, Pokemon is actually anime.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to them, Pokemon and a lot of these Yu-Gi-Oh! And these titles were just animation. So it wasn't even being categorized that way when you actually run the numbers. So, you know, to really kind of make them understand the whole size of the market and the potential of the market and, you know, how Warner was missing out on it. I mean, you know, and then they were airing Pokemon at the time on Warner TV, but then they weren't getting home entertainment rights to it, which, you know, in hindsight was crazy, you know. So they were really advertising for, you know, Nintendo and, you know, 4Kids and all those people and really not reaping the benefits of it. So, you know, all those things together with Animatrix success, I mean, it's basically pitching the whole concept. And it took about, about a year and a half for it to happen, and they created a new division, and then they put me onto it. And then just around that time, finally, the entire Warner group kind of come around to it, and all of a sudden, they formed something called a business committee, where they were, you know, systematically trying to get into anime across all platforms, you know, like TV, you know, entertainment, you know, home video, consumer products, and whatnot. And, you know, and I was a representative on the home entertainment side. I got really lucky, you know, I mean, DC Comics was in the mix and whatnot. So, I mean, at the time I was working on various projects that might be Warner backed or anything that's kind of follow up to Animatrix. And I think at the time what was being talked about was a Batman anime, which eventually became Gotham Knight after I left.
Right.
I think Warner was going after a lot of titles as well, like Naruto and whatnot. But by that time, I think Japanese companies were kind of coming to realization the market was too good over here. So it was really hard to get at those titles. And also Status Quo, you know, with four kids and whatnot, I mean, it was already so strong that unless it was very coordinated effort, it was very tough to do so. But, you know, when you're dealing with a huge conglomerate company like Warner's, I mean, they got, you know, great, you know, means and power to get, you know, to, you know, really get into any genre. But it really wasn't as fast as I would like it to be. So just around that time, I, you know, as I was getting frustrated, I ran into Appleseed. And, you know, when I first saw it, I mean, it was at, I think, at AFM in Santa Monica. I realized, you know, a couple of my acquaintances were friends with director Aramaki. Mm-hmm. And just around that time, I also became friends with the people who produced it in Japan, the company called Mikan and Basara. And so, you know, I figured, you know what, this might just be the next thing for anime, you know, I mean, going to CG. I mean, Final Fantasy was done before, but I really didn't think of it as anime. Yeah. But Appleseed was really, to me, a new frontier. Yeah. So, you know, along with that and a whole bunch of other projects that I was considering, I just decided to leave and then just strike out on my own. And so the next project became Appleseed sequel, Appleseed Ex Machina. And I was helping with Appleseed's marketing and PR and whatnot. And with Ex Machina, I thought maybe we could make it go a little bigger, and was trying to look for a perfect marriage here to help, you know, to really kind of plan for, you know, widening the appeal of Appleseed. And yeah, I mean, so that led to that relationship with John Woo, and then, you know, he came on board as a producer as well. And so, you know, that was my next title, Appleseed Ex Machina.
If we could just back up a little bit, I just wanted to clarify for our less industry savvy listeners that AFM is American Film Market. It's a big industry hobnob that goes on for a couple days in Santa Monica every year.
And occasionally anime gets shown there every now and then.
Right, yep. But it's really industry only. It's people looking for distributors and things like that.
Yeah. Did you have any creative involvement in Ex Machina?
Yeah, in Ex Machina, what happened was, I mean, that's really where I got my wish, you know? I mean, rather than just, you know, running business and doing pitches. So, you know, I mean, working with John, I mean, John Woo, actually, the reason I thought of John was, you know, he was my hero from my, I think, my middle school days in Korea when I first saw his film called Better Tomorrow.
Mm.
I mean, he's just humongous in Korea, you know, for that film, before he even became a star here in Hollywood. So I've been following his career. I've always wanted to work with him. And I thought, well, I know John always wanted to try his hand at CG animation. So why not show him Appleseed and then ask him if he wants to get involved in sequel? And he really, really liked it when he saw it. We did a screening for him separately and his partner, Terrence Chang. And they really loved it and wanted to come on board. So to me, it was like almost a marriage made in heaven, you know, with Aramaki. So in between, you know, we tried, you know, we worked on the scripts. We worked on, giving feedbacks on the storyboard. And John had a lot to do with some of the, you know, action sequences. I mean, it really was a true collaboration. And I was right in between working with John and Aramaki on that, as well as working with writers in Japan to, you know, flesh out the scripts. And then we had to also work out the versions in the state side, because there are, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, John's side here with the John's creative team, you know, as well as Japan's creative team and writers. So that all needed to be worked in. So, you know, I was kind of in the middle of that. And I guess being able to speak both languages really helped, because then you work as a glue between the two. And, you know, once you start, you know, I mean, once you, I guess, like, really have, you know, seen enough of the movies and anime, then, you know, you bring in your own perspectives as producer to see, you know, okay, well, this could work, that could, you know, that might not work, and, you know, really be in that creative process. And, yeah, I mean, it really was a great experience.
So, creatively, just what informs you? Like, what are some of your favorite films? What do you consider your inspiration when you're working on a film like that?
Oh, you know, I mean, it's always toughest to question when someone asks me, you know, what's your most favorite film or most favorite anime? Because, you know, the answer is depends, right?
Right.
So, you know, what genre are you asking? I mean, but it's just really hard to pick one. in a movie, I would always say, you know, something like, you know, Godfather is my favorite, but that doesn't fly. But, you know, in genre like this, I usually, I mean, I think most Japanese anime directors as well, you know, but for a genre like Appleseed, I always kind of look back on something like Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. You know, always people look at things like Star Wars as well. But I think Blade Runner has a huge implications. I mean, a huge impact on Japanese director's sensibility, especially when it comes to titles like Akira, Ghost in the Shell.
Bubblegum Crisis, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's something that really informs a lot of the films out there. You know, and then some of the sci-fi classics that, you know, you're over here in the States as well. And in Japan, they also get influenced by their own, you know, people, too. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that they work on, like Gundams and, you know, Cobras and, you know, Bubblegum Crisis and whatnot, a lot of those things actually, you know, works to inform works, you know, titles like Appleseed as well. So, I mean, there are various influences. I would say to me, you know, something like Blade Runner. But at the time, John was involved as well. So if you look at some of the character, how the characters are set up and their relationships, you could kind of, you know, harken it back to some of John's films. So that was John, really, and John Steen, who brought those ideas in and you know, worked them into the script. So, yeah, I mean, I think both, you know, some of John's, you know, finest films, you know, about the relationship between two men, you know, a romantic relationship with a woman and, you know, that whole triangle issues and, you know, how it's...
The diving sideways while shooting two guns and...
Yeah, doves. Shooting two that too.
Right.
Is but, you know, what's interesting, actually, is, you know, I figure, I mean, I really... admire John for, I mean, I thought I just admired John for a lot of people really think of John as John Woo style, but, you know, those two gun, you know, action and whatnot, but really, you know, what makes those, you know, worth something is really how he sets up these emotional, you know, tone of the entire film. So really the drama informs the action. And I really was, I learned that actually, I mean, really firsthand. When he was working on some of the storyboard ideas and then script ideas for Ex Machina, you know, because, you know, he, a lot of the setups that he brings makes his action mean something. And a lot of people now can, you know, is basically doing what John was able to do or even do a lot more with CG that's available to them. I mean, if you look at, you know, titles like Wanted, I mean, obviously that's, you know, I mean, that's like, that's taking it to the next level, obviously, you know, with CG and whatnot. But it doesn't have the emotional core to me like John's film did back when. So, you know, I really think that was an important element that John brought in. It, you know, on top of these action sequences, obviously.
Was he easy to work with? I mean, I would imagine you sort of have to let his creative sensibilities kind of override whatever you might be thinking would be a good idea.
We're talking about John? Or
yeah, John Woo.
John is... I heard he is a really scary person on his film set, but when you meet him in person, he is probably the nicest gentleman you'll ever meet, and he's very courteous. And I think as a director, in, you know, especially in Hong Kong in his early days, he faced a lot of difficulties. People really kind of restricting his creative freedoms and ideas and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So he would come in to compliment Aramaki, and I'm not just saying that to, you know, to make him sound nice, but he really did that. He told Aramaki, "Look, you're the director, and this is your film." And if you don't like my ideas, then you don't take it. But and I think that kind of human relationships, I mean, really, creators really get moved by that. And I think Aramaki-san was really moved by some, you know, what John was doing for him.
Well, that's a really kind of rare thing in an executive producer, let alone a celebrity executive producer.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, and you know, and then some of the things that John was coming up with was just wonderful, you know, and it just. You know, I mean, it would start with actually Aramaki's storyboard, and then John would go through, you know, each one of them and then come up with his own idea. He had a long note that he came up with. And then, you know, Aramaki would just sit there and just do a, you know, do a new sketch and, you know, to match that. And I think he'll sit, you know, let it sit for a little bit and gel in his mind and somehow try to make that, you know, realized on screen as well. So it really was a true collaboration at the time. And I think, and for Aramaki Song, I mean, that was like a second, you know, directorial film, right? So it's his sophomore effort. I mean, and then, you know, to go from Appleseed, you know, to Ex Machina, where budget's more than double, then, you know, you have John Woo coming in. I mean, it could be a little intimidating, but I think, you know, it really, really, John really made it everything so easy and was very complimentary, you know, and you know, you couldn't ask for a better producer than that, you know?
So before we talk about Halo a little bit, I wanted to bring up, you were the producer on a live-action King of Fighters movie that has apparently doesn't have an American distributor yet?
Yeah, well, we just delivered that film. So the final delivery actually was last week.
Oh, wow.
So the sales is going to happen probably starting with the Berlin Film Festival. Yeah, that's just a nice little action flick.
tell us a little bit about it, because I saw the trailer. I took a there's a little bit of information out there about it.
Yeah, but most of us know nothing about this project.
Yeah, so how did that come together? What do you, I mean? Tell us about that film.
Well, it's just one of the titles that actually happened, you know. I mean, before others. I mean, there are obviously, as a producer, I have a lot of you know, a lot of projects cooking right now, and that just happened to be one of the films that some of the financiers really kind of took interest in, and they wanted to run with it. So it, you know, I mean, it was pretty hair-raising experience to try to complete the financing last year. But to me, I mean, the reason I wanted to start that project was because I really, really liked it. Like the images that I saw, actually. I think it's a Shinkiro who did a lot of design. I like Shinkiro's design a lot. Shinkiro, by the way, is the designer from old Capcom days in King of Fighters, and now I think he's at Capcom. I think you can see now his designs on the most recent game is Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did all those package designs. If you see his design, it's really striking how his, you know, his drawing is almost like, you know, CG rendered image, but it's just the wonderful renderings of like Gatchaman and whatnot, a lot of these anime characters, and also Street Fighter characters and SNK characters. And I really fell in love with his images. And I found out later on that King of Fighters actually had a story behind it, unlike you know, other fighting games. So, you know, I mean, I, you know, there's many different scripts that were worked on from different sagas, you know, I mean, from different game iterations, and you know, it turned into this film eventually. I mean, shooting just finished mid last year, and it was kind of crazy because Halo was going on at the same time as this one, so. You know, we wrapped on editing and just finished the effects. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, we have a great team of... when it comes to action, I think we have a great team. It's the team that worked on that, you know, directly, and sometimes like a body doubles for people like Matt Damon and like a Bourne series. And I think they did action for 300 and, you know, Rambo and whatnot. I mean, it is the top action team from Hollywood. So we really had them, you know, bring... You know, like four stunt coordinators, action choreographers, whereas only major movies will only have one or two. And partly because we had some of their actors involved as our actors, as you know, and on screen as well. So, but anyways, you know, I think it's great action. I wish I had a lot more involvement in the script, which I have to admit I didn't.
just so people know.
I'm only one person. It's a fun film. It's a fun action film. I mean, I wouldn't say anything more than that about the film, because I think you'll see for yourself and find, you know, and decide for yourself, obviously. But I'm
and you're still trying to sell it.
But it's very entertaining. Let's just say that. So.
Is it? Can you say it's better than that Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li movie?
You know, I actually didn't even see that film yet.
Lucky you.
Heard pretty bad things about it. I saw the trailer. I heard, because some of the people who finished up the action sequence there was from our action team as well.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it's not as good when it comes to action. I think they had more budget than us. We had some budget issues because our financing was just gelling together when the you know, when this whole economic crisis actually just happened.
When the
market was taking a hit. So it was actually a miracle for it to come together, but our budget obviously took a hit as well. So So I heard it's a bigger scale because of that. I heard Tekken is the same way. I mean, it's bigger scale, bigger budget. But when it comes to action, I heard ours is the best. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. And really, I mean, I guess marketplace will have to, you know, fans will have to decide.
I hope you'll keep us informed when you get a U.S. Distributor.
Oh yeah, I will.
So let's talk about Halo. This is out 2 weeks, I think, from when we're recording this. How did you get involved in this? And were you a gamer? Were you into Halo? Tell us how that got started.
Halo is an interesting case because Aramaki and I are now partners on a lot of projects. I mean, we don't just do these producing of titles, but we also help in the background of, you know, some of the titles that we can't really speak of right now. But we were looking for the next title. What would we do as our next title? You know, and I was talking to him at, I think there was an Ex Machina screening at Smithsonian about a year and a half ago. And I remember in a hotel room, we were just huddling and talking about, you know, what should we do next? And at the time, I think, you know, I had a lot of magazines around about, you know, Halo 3 release, and I was just really enamored of the image, you know, images. I mean, the artwork, I mean, it was just incredible artwork, and it just seemed really cool and deep. I gotta admit, at the time, I wasn't much of a player because I'm like the Japanese game players. I mean, I really suck at FPS, first person shooter. Mm-hmm. But I really thought the images were striking, and it kind of went, you know, it was kind of interesting too, because back when I was an international distributor for a lot of the games that I licensed. I mean, I used to be an international game licensee and distributor. And then I one of the titles I actually went after was Halo at the time when it was a PC game. And the Bungiesoft was out in Chicago, I believe. And so I remember visiting them, and I remember seeing, you know, some of the designers had a lot of these anime figures on the desk. So obviously there were a lot of them were anime fans, and I think they ended up doing an anime inspired game called Oni or something.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember that.
I kind of had a tie from that point. And then when we were trying to, you know, when we were having a discussion to license it outside of the States, all of a sudden there was an announcement that Microsoft was buying them out. So that was that, right?
Right.
So. You know, I mean, and Halo obviously went on to become great success after that, you know, for Xbox. But I really was just really was enamored of the images and the lore. It was just striking. So I kind of brought it up to Aramaki-san and said, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, this really looks cool. And he looks at it and is like, oh, you know, I'm the legendary player of Halo, you know, and you know, I mean, those of you who know Halo, I mean, legendary player is the most difficult, like, you know, level of, you know, I mean, play at the Halo, right? I mean, it's, you really have to, I mean, there are only a few people who actually became like a legendary, who beat the legendary level at Halo, and he was one, and that's surprising. I mean, I gotta explain the context. I mean, that's surprising, because in Japan, FPS is not really that big as much as, you know, third-person shooter, mm-hmm. Let alone, I mean, Halo is huge, humongous here in Japan. You know, it's big, but it's, you know, I mean, it's not like US, you know, America big, right?
Well, yeah, that plus it's an Xbox exclusive, and the Xbox is not popular in Japan.
Yeah, so. Xbox only sold so much over there at the time, yeah. And I think it's picked up to become like a million-plus units by now, so it's really picking up speed now. But back then, I mean, really, you know, not many people were playing Xbox at the time.
Yeah.
And to hear that, and also to hear that from the mouth of an anime director, mm-hmm. Who's like 40-plus year old.
Yeah.
You know, it's just impossible, right? And so I was like, really? You know? And so, but we're like, yeah, you know, but at the time, like, I think the Peter Jackson, that whole live-action project was still being talked about. So we're like, you know, bad chance that we're going to get that. So why don't we try to do something like that, you know? I mean, why don't we try to come up with our own space epic or cyberpunk epic? So, you know, we've been talking about it, kicking ideas back and forth, and then I eventually heard that the movie wasn't going to happen anymore. And I kind of thought one day, you know, what the hell, you know? Why not try this? And I told him, look, why don't we just try to do Halo if we can get it? And he's like, yeah, okay. And I guess he thought Fat Chance at the time, too. But then around that time, I think John Ledford, you know, who's the head of Sentai Filmworks now, who's, you know, old ADV, the new ADV, that is.
We like to call them Neo-ADV.
Yeah, the Neo-ADV. you know, John became a good friend of mine around that time, and John suggested, you know, I can make some introductions, and I'm like, okay. And, you know, we kind of went to talk to Seattle, and I think, you know, Microsoft responded at the time. So I was drawing up a proposal and everything, and I was going to take my time writing it. But then, and I guess I got an email one of the days. It's like, yeah, so what's going on with that proposal? So I was like, oh, okay. So I rushed it over, and then we had I had a quick meeting with you know, one of the, you know, Halo team's business development person at Comic-Con, and I made my pitch, and I guess it must have clicked. So called me right away, said let's go. So I called up Aramaki-sang and said, look, you want to do this? And he's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna drop everything I do now. So I mean, that's sort of how it happened. You know, I guess I was trying to make my pitch designed around my experience with Animatrix, as well as the possibility of CG animation movie. So I was kind of giving them options to, you know, as to, you know, which one, you know, we should go with. I think they were interested in both, but you know, initially, I think what they wanted to tackle was the you know, obviously the omnibus approach, which is the anthology approach. Because the world was so big and the universe is just so detailed, and there are a lot of histories, a lot of layers. And I just thought, you know, to bring in fans, not only, you know, not just Halo fans, but really general public or even anime fans, we need to really properly introduce this title. And I mean, there's no other, you know, way to do that other than anthology, right? So I just thought it would be perfect. Example for that would be Animatrix, so I used that model, and I think that really rang a bell with them. So yeah, I mean, from that point on, I mean, it was full speed on, you know, and I think from the start to finish, it took maybe less than a year and a half, and that's, I mean, those of you who know anything about production, like, I mean, anime production, I mean, that's...
Yeah, that's nothing.
Incredible. and really, to even be able to get the caliber of talent that we got, that's incredible. So, yeah, I mean, so it's just everything kind of fell into place. And normally, you know, when a title happens, you know, these things happen. You know, I mean, everything just somehow falls into place and... You know, it's just God's doing, you know. So it just all came together, right? And, I mean, there were a lot of trials and a lot of fires that I had to go through. I mean, I lost hair, actually, last year. and I'm not just joking. I actually lost hair. but we actually went to the finish line, and now we're about a couple weeks away from the release.
So in terms of audience for this thing, now I'm sure you've been asked a million times, like, well, anime fans aren't really into Halo and Halo gamers aren't really into anime. What audience were you trying to please most here?
You know, both, really. I mean, it's, when you look at Animatrix, I mean, do you think we were trying to please anime fans? I mean, I don't think so.
I don't really know.
You know, right? I mean, it's really not anime. I mean, right. Anime in stereotypical anime, right?
Right.
So
the Moe tricks.
No, I mean, but I think I wanted to be a little more commercial with some of the episodes. Mm-hmm. And I think I mean, one of the IG's episode called Homecoming is definitely that ringer. I mean, because it's the director who did Noir and whatnot. I mean, so even the look of it is like that.
Koichi Mashiro.
Yeah, the Bones episode is anime. I mean, that's the team that directed Eureka 7. Right. So, you know, that's that ringer for anime. I mean, that one, of all the episodes, I think one, I mean, gets the most attention and reaction from Japan, actually. In the States, I would think it's Aramaki-san's episode, the CG episode.
Yeah. Having seen clips, I agree, yeah.
Right, definitely. So, but to me, it's like, you know, I mean, Halo, I don't know. I mean, why? I don't know why anime fans wouldn't like Halo and Halo fans wouldn't like anime. I mean, if you look at Halo, I mean, I can tell you that a lot of people who designed that world and then designed a lot of the, you know, the suits and mechs and whatnot, those people are actually big anime fans. So a lot of those designs are anime inspired. I mean, I'm not going to name names because I haven't spoken with them directly, but I heard things.
We wouldn't want to impugn their nerd cred.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, but just think of the silhouette of Master Chief's suit, you know, and then how the helmet looks. I mean,
right. It looks like bubblegum.
Does that ring a bell? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no crossover. It's just that I think the stereotype, or at least the common knowledge, would dictate that anime fans are more into Japanese role-playing games and stuff like that, and Halo gamers are really mainstream. You know, they're excited about the Super Bowl this weekend. You know, that's an extremely mainstream audience. Halo is, you know, billion seller or whatever in the States. And anime, and Justin and I have talked about this before, and actually I want to get your take on this. Anime is not as cool as it was when the Animatrix came out. Like, when Animatrix came out, anime was still considered totally cool.
Cutting edge.
Yeah, cutting edge. Now it seems like it's fallen into the realm of geekdom only. Now, obviously, as a producer on Halo Legends, you probably don't want to agree with that. But
You know what? I mean, I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And here's my take on it. I mean, and I don't know if I'm giving my trade secrets away, but, you know, look at numbers-wise. I mean, look at titles that were hits and that really sold over 100,000 units. You know, that went on to sell 200,000 units, 300,000 units, 500,000 units. What are those titles?
Right? Bebop, I mean, Ninja
Akira,
Scroll.
Ghost in the Shell, right?
Yeah.
Ninja Scroll, Appleseed. I mean, Vampire D. I mean, you see the patterns there, right?
Right.
And then we're talking stereotypical anime, right?
Right.
Stereotypical. I mean, I don't want to stereotype any anime, but...
Oh, like, please, go ahead.
Like a big eye anime stuff, right? Like the, right. Like, you know...
Let's just say Love Hina.
Yeah. I mean, those titles are 30,000 unit sellers, 50,000 unit sellers.
We're lucky.
They
now
used to
maybe 10,000 unit sellers, right?
Yeah. Now maybe 100 unit sellers.
Maybe now the 100 unit sellers. So yes, you're right. I mean, I think fandom, like core fandom, who actually watches Love Hina and all these titles, as good as those titles are, you know, I mean, you know, they have their own merits. They do have core, you know, fandoms, and I think those titles are, you know, never go over 100,000 units per se, right? I mean, so the reason being, in order to reach beyond 100,000 units, you need to reach beyond the core anime fandom, obviously, right?
Right.
So you look at titles like, you know, Karasu, you look at titles like Appleseed and whatnot, you know, Akira, Ghost in the Shell. I mean, those titles actually crossed over, you know, Cowboy Bebop crossover. So you need to be able to cross over, and I think that's only in certain genre, what we would call cool anime, right? I mean,
right.
Stuff like Bebop is actually a prime example of that. I mean, edgy stuff. You know, Akira was edgy at the time. Ghost in the Shell was edgy at the time.
Right.
Striking imagery, you know, great quality of animation, targeting young adult demographics. And I think that's an area where a lot of Japanese producers decided to neglect. The reason they did that is because, not because they're short-sighted, but because they're concerned with their domestic market first and overseas market later. And also the business model was set up in a way that even if Ninja Scroll was such a hit, I don't think a lot of that money made its way back to Japan, rather ended up here, you know, with distributors and whatnot. But that's business model. I mean, nobody did anything bad. I mean, it's just business model, right? Mm-hmm. But if that's the business model, then they needed to find a new business model that made it viable for everyone to benefit so that Japan would continue to produce titles like Ninja Scroll. But they don't, right? Because of the domestic reality, and that's what they're immediately faced with. So for me, I think bridging that gap is a very important theme. You know, to survive as a producer and to be able to continue to work on titles, I mean, that's an important theme. And I think Halo Legends could be the best example. Like, Animatrix is the best example of how it can be done, right? I mean, Gotham Knight is another example of how that can be done. I think relying on Western IP and trying to do anime on it, you know, only has certain limitations. So it needs to be titles that are coming up from Japan to really fill that gap as well. But at this time, you know, trying to finance that is really, you know, you really end up pulling your hair out. Mm-hmm. But I mean, so that's the situation that we're facing. And right now, with fans not buying DVDs anymore because of, I guess, number one, economy, two, retailers going down, And three, you know, obviously online piracy. I mean, that's hurting everybody so much. I mean, it's heartbreaking, really, to see all these people losing jobs and companies going down. And that's where we're at right now. So I think for anime to survive as a, you know, cool anime genre or that, you know, stay in that frame of mind, we need to really then kind of start looking at how to serve the markets that are beyond fandom. Because fandom right now, to me, aren't buying. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the reality. Yeah, so you know, so that's my take on it.
So it basically, and I would completely agree that Halo is a good fit for a mainstream anime project that has the crossover appeal. I would agree with that, I think. Mm-hmm. So before we get to we have questions from our listeners for you. But before we get into that, I wanted to know, you've worked on a lot of these anthology projects for Western IP. What's your dream project? Like, what would you want to work on most of all?
Oh boy, that's a good question. some of them are, I'm actually working on them, so I can't reveal. But I'd love to get my hands on Gatchaman.
Okay, Gatchaman. Hey, yeah. Well, hey, you know, Imagine Studios won't be around too much longer, so you might be able to take that from them. Oh, and I have to ask about this, and you probably don't want to answer any questions about it, but you are listed as a producer on the Ethereal live action Evangelion movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So is that just buried under a stack of papers on your desk or what?
It's a lot of paperwork right now, but we're with a very big producer right now.
There's actually movement on that project?
Yes. It's not only just the movement. It's very active.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. The thing is, you know, Hollywood, you got to understand that, you know, clearing the paperwork that's required by the studios and by everyone involved, I mean, that's just the have to fight. So once that's resolved, I think it would be on fast track. So we're hoping that it'll start moving, like, you know, even next year.
So that begs the question, maybe this is a leap of logic on my part, but I have to assume you got a bit of a boost from the success of Transformers.
But I got to tell you, I mean, I took it around. I mean, this is after, you know, actually the whole Weta effort with, you know, that John made. And I spoke with Weta after that as well. I spoke with Richard Taylor and everyone. And then I put together a package and I shopped it around town. Yes and no. It's because Evangelion is just very heady. Right, I mean, it's got so many elements in it, and that really needs to be broken down to explain to Hollywood communities. I mean, a lot of times, I mean, studios really, you know, unless really they understand the franchise, unless you can sum it up in one sentence or two, it's really, really tough to kind of get them interested. So initially, it helped that it was what they would consider a giant robot project, and you know, obviously, people will kill me if I say this is a giant robot project, and I don't consider it as one. But obviously, that's one element that helped. Yeah. And I think, you know, with 2 being that much of a hit, you know, Transformers 2 being that, you know, being the biggest movie last year, yes, it does help. But look at how it's helping, you know, other robot related titles, right? So it's a very elusive thing. But I think right now we're with a producer and a studio that really understands beyond the whole, you know, mega impact, or I mean the whole robot run, you know, destroying the city, that type of ideas. They're really looking beyond that and really looking at the drama, human elements, even to those elements that appeal to otaku. And I'm really happy about that. So I'm hoping that we clear up all the necessary paperwork and then really move on with it, go make the movie.
At the same time, we shouldn't expect the last 20 minutes to take place with quick cuts of Shinji on a folding chair on top of the world.
Probably, right.
Probably. But I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there. You might have some success if you cast Shia LaBeouf as Shinji and Megan Fox as Asuka. Just throw that out there.
We'll see. I mean, if you know, when it happens, it's going to be a giant movie project. So once it becomes that big, I don't know how much of a say I'll have. But yeah. Okay.
And actually, just going on from there, you do have this sort of a long relationship with John Ledford and now Section 23 Film, Sentai Filmworks. And yep. The dubbing for Halo Legends was done at Seraphim Studios.
Yep.
And you've used them for a number of projects. What's your experience like there? And I don't really see them mentioned a lot in the promotion for Halo Legends among anime fans. But what's your experience there? And you obviously keep going back to them. So how's that working out?
Well, it really started, with Ex Machina. I mean, when I was dubbing that here, I sold Ex Machina to Warner's, as you guys know, and Warner Brothers asked me to handle English. So, and I was weighing my options, and, ADV at the time reached out to me, and I looked at various samples. But what really gave me confidence was actually, Stephen Foster, and what, how he would understand the project at the time and how I wanted to take Ex Machina. So I went there and I really had a great time working with Stephen, and the actors there were just wonderful. Yeah, I really had a good experience working with them. I really had good experience working with the actors. I really liked the flexibility that they offered and the sensibility. I mean, Stephen really, like when you communicate one thing to him, he would really, because sometimes you're trying to articulate what you're thinking and it's very hard to do that, but then he would actually articulate that for you on the spot. And he's just very good at coming up with, the right sentences to fit that moment and how that should, match the mouth movements and whatnot, which was a big theme. It's tougher in CG anime because, typically you would actually have mouth match Japanese lips, right? Mm-hmm. Lip movements. So it's very specific, unlike 2D. So it's a tough job to do it, but he really pulled off, he really did a great job with it. So I think come Halo Legends, because it was so chaotic, with so many episodes, and we needed so many actors, and I really needed to have that confidence and know, even when I'm not there in person, that we would be able to sync. And I knew Steven would be able to pull that off, and, had a great relationship. I mean, I also had some of the game jobs being filtered through there and working with Steven and Joey, who was the producer on it. So I really had a great working relationship. So for a complex project like Halo, I really, really just needed that. The team that who understood what I wanted, what the directors wanted, and also just be in sync with each other and just being very flexible and being there for you 24/7. And they are like that. So I was really happy with that. And John, I think I've been friends with John even before then, I guess. But, I think our relationship, became stronger, even after that. And, he's a really good friend of mine. And I really think he's one of the assets, for the anime industry right now and anime market. I really wanted to stick around and do well. And so, I wish nothing but the best for him.
So is that when you got involved with the Evangelion film or?
Evangelion, yeah. I think at one point, I suggested that I would help him take it to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Because I think at the time, because of the whole anime market crash was happening. I mean, the reason it stopped in its tracks was not because John wasn't paying attention to it or anything, or he ran into trouble. I mean, he actually amassed a considerable amount of money, actually, financing for the film. And, going around with Richard Taylor. He really, really, took it to a level. But then I think he just needed to stop because, the whole market was falling apart at the time, right?
He had a company to try to resuscitate.
Yeah, so he needed to go back and refocus. So kind of fell on the wayside. So I told him, look, it's going and there's a time limit to this. So why don't you let me take it and run with it in Hollywood? And also he needed, I think, somebody who kind of understood the system here and really take it to distribute, the studios and really the producers here who could also work with us. Which he needed, I think, I thought. So he agreed with that. So, we worked together on it. So I think that was about, a couple years ago, a year and a half ago?
Are they still part of that project?
John? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's all very interesting information. I'm really surprised to find out that there's actually movement on that because it's as you know, it's been kind of a punchline for the last, 4 or 5 years.
Darn it, we lost one of our go-to jokes.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, the project's been, other than the time that John had to basically focus, his efforts on his, his company, it's been active. But it's like that, just think of any of the films that's been announced and that, it takes just a long, long, long time to gel together. It's really, you know, it's really not an easy process. So
yeah, yeah.
Who knows how many of the announced anime-related projects will ever see the light of day?
Yeah,
I don't want to say that in podcasts, but I know a lot of the anime-themed projects are kind of in limbo right now. And you know, I mean, some of the titles you guys know, but they're just having script problems, politics. I mean, it might just not have to do anything to do with the project itself. It's just politics or after schedules.
I've heard that Dragon Ball Z being what it was, or Dragon Ball Evolution being what it was, scared a lot of people.
Yeah, in Japan, people are scared. So,
well, yeah, not only that, we haven't seen a success yet. Speed Racer was a huge bomb. Dragon Ball was a huge bomb. Astro Boy was a huge bomb. So we haven't seen a success yet.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, no, you're right. Needs a success, you know, and as you guys know, Hollywood jumps on success. So if one thing is successful, then I think it'll continue. But
and Hollywood is also in hardcore retreat mode right now.
Yeah. Yes, it's a tough market. It's a really tough market right now. It's not easy for producers, obviously. But
Sony just laid off 400 people this week.
Oh yeah, no, that was another heartbreaker. You know, I mean, I heard that from a friend of mine at Sony first, so I just really felt bad because home entertainment, I mean, is the closest to anime right now. So just to hear a lot of people, you know, just losing their jobs. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, I think piracy is the most severe right now in anime, but I think it's now crossing over to mainstream, and I think it's really hitting them big time. You'll see a lot more of these announcements. Until 3D Blu-ray really comes into the main line and becomes the really major force, we might see this continue unless there's a new business model. And people are just have just too many options of entertainment now, and also just too easy to just watch, you know, get things for free. And once you're used to free, it's very hard to go back. And it's not as easy as music where you just charge $1 for a title, you know what I mean? So it's going to be a tough couple years for sure.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to these listener questions. We can blow through these pretty briefly. It shouldn't take too long here. Mark FBR would like to know your thoughts on why comic books, American comic books, have had such success being adapted for the screen, but games and anime really haven't.
Well, I mean, part of that is, I think American comics is really woven into American psyche, right? I mean, it's really, people have grown up with it. So you have a lot more creators and people who have grown up with those things. And it's closer to skin than anything. And I think you got to give a lot of credit to people who first produced Batman and whatnot, and also someone like Avi Arad, who's done a phenomenal job, I mean, with Spider-Man and X-Men and whatnot. I mean, just being able to produce wonderful films. I mean, I think technologies, you know, CG technologies development actually, you know, and then resurgence of comic movies really kind of synced just at the right time to happen, you know, to make a phenomenon like that. But I think people are interested in seeing these phenomena and wonderful, epic, you know, happening on screen. So I think, you know, it's not necessarily, I don't think, you know, for example, like Iron Man is probably as big as some of the big animes here, right? I mean, it really was, you know, but what it is it's closer to American, you know, American culture, and a lot of people have grown up with it. So it's closer to skin, and they also have previous successes that, you know, Spider-Man and Batman and whatnot. So it kind of feeds itself. You know, once it's a success and you have a good guardian who's taking care of it and then guiding it, then, and also when you look at Marvel, I mean, and DC, they are coordinated and guided by a you know, people who are really fiercely protective of these, you know, universes. And it's actually consistent and self-sufficient, right? Self-contained. Mm-hmm. And you have these two entities who are fiercely protective of these franchises and really trying to push it into the right direction. Anime doesn't have that. Anime is just many different people have different IPs, and you have to trace it back to Japan. It's very hard to clear the rights. And it's hard to also to find then people who are willing to guide it through the process, who are influential enough. So it's really trying to find that perfect combination. Once you have the right combination and have that, you know, a guiding force, then I think anime could become, successful material for, live action adaptation.
There just needs to be a good, solid hit. Okay.
One hit, and you need a good guiding hand. Yeah.
Right. Couple from Ed Sizemore over at comicsworthreading.com. Will there be more Appleseed movies?
Yes.
Okay. Do you see John Woo doing any more anime collaborations?
Yeah, if he wants to. I mean, he's been so busy with Redcliffe. He's working on other films. If he's interested in, I think there are a lot of people are all ears in Japan. And Redcliffe was the biggest hit foreign, biggest international movies of all time last year, actually. Like, it was somewhere above, like, $70 million. He's very welcomed in Japan right now.
Right. Are you ever looking to direct anything yourself, or would you rather stay a producer?
Yeah, I thought I'd kind of get into directing when I could afford to lose on projects.
Right.
So these days, no.
Yeah, no. maybe one day. But I really enjoy supporting directors and really, being able to, pull together projects. I mean, it's a very tough process, but it's an enjoyable process. So maybe someday, but for now, I think I'd like to stay producer.
Okay. From Fist of the MFK, a little confrontational here, why does the live-action King of Fighters movie not resemble the games at all?
Good question.
Because half of that hair defies gravity?
Yeah. I mean, the same reasons why Dragon Ball couldn't exactly be adapted the same way in a live action. I mean, when you try, it ends up being looking silly. So, and then also economic reality and the market realities come into force. I mean, maybe someday I can get a chance to explain how that dynamic works together to, conspire together to create a film that's completely different from the original source material, but that's for some other day.
Well, we'll have you on again. From SX Animedia, why was the role of Master Chief recast for Halo Legends?
Just because we wanted to. it was all done under, Microsoft supervision. So, we had their approval and everything. And I think for anime, we wanted specific actors who could pull off that role. And also, it was also an issue of securing the original actor's time in the given production time that we had. I mean, we really didn't have a lot of time to pull things together. We were trying to afford as much as time as possible to animation production. We really needed to be efficient and just pick the right person and go for it. So, but we've done that with Microsoft's full approval. We'll see. I mean, what happens? I mean, if there are any future iterations, I mean, how the voice actor situation will work out. But for Legends, I mean, that was our choice.
Okay. From the same guy, are you working with John Ledford or Seraphim Digital on any other project besides Evangelion?
No, I'm always talking with John about other stuff. Whenever I could, I also help because I also come from business background, so I try to help when I could. Yeah, I mean, it's always an open question. I'd like to help him when I can.
And finally, from Yotaru Vegeta, since you've got King of Fighters coming out and Tekken live action movie is coming out soon, are you a fighting gamer? Do you play a lot of fighting games? And if so, what's your favorite?
Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm more of a Street Fighter person. But the reason I wanted King of Fighters was because, like I said before, I really liked the designer Shinkiro's images, and it really fascinated me. And after that, the story itself. Gamer, I mean, I really suck at fighting games. I mean, my reflex is really not good. Mm-hmm. I'm really not much of a player when it comes to fighting games. One thing that I'm trained on is, Ryu's character in Street Fighter. So that's probably about it.
All the combinations memorized and everything.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that about wraps it up. Thank you so much for your time and your insight. We really appreciated it.
Yeah, this is great stuff.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot, and we will see you all next week.